Welcome to Equity Gurus, A Closer Look, where you, the investor, get to listen as Chris Perry grills the best and the brightest in the corporate sector to help you find out who's the wheat and who's the chaff. Listen in.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are not necessarily shared by people who are wrong.
And large shareholder of the company. And we acquired a project from Denison called Mourne. This was a project that actually my head geologist, Rick Kaczmarski, spent quite a bit of time and did a lot of work on back in the early mid-90s, made a high-grade discovery there back then. And ultimately, his company, JNR, in which Moore was a part of that company, was acquired by Denison. So it's come full circle. And really, part of that deal and getting that deal done revolved around the fact that it was coming back into a company that has Rick Kaczmarski, the head geologist, basically overseeing the exploration going forward, him and his team based in Saskatoon. And so, you know, we feel, as does I think Denison, that there's still a lot of value to be unlocked on this project. They do have a buyback option for 51%. Obviously still maintain a vested interest in the project through that. But we feel there's a lot more value to be unlocked, a lot more exploration upside. We feel that Rick and his team, which made the initial discovery back in the early mid-2000s, are the right team to go and do that. So, you know, there's a good fit here. And I think that once we got that deal done, it really transformed the company from, you know, a real nano cap, micro cap, company with, you know, relatively earlier stage exploration projects to a company that is able to withstand a difficult uranium market, flourish in a difficult uranium market, go out there, get these deals done, bring in strategic partners like a Denison, and ultimately look to make that next big discovery in the Athabasca Basin. You know, that's a big part of our story. We're a discovery-driven exploration company with projects throughout the basin, in particular our flagship, the Mourne project, which we just finished our first drill program on. You know, we really do feel that there is the potential there for much more high-grade mineralization uranium to be found. We know that there's the high-grade Maverick Zone. We went back in. We drilled just under 5,500 meters in and around that main Maverick Zone. It's a 4-kilometer-long corridor. And really only a kilometer and a half of it has been systematically explored. We reported results from these first 15 drill holes. We had one of the holes return 21% U308 over a meter and a half. We had another hole return just over 9% over a meter and a half. And these high-grade zones are within longer zones of uranium, relatively high-grade uranium mineralization. Mm-hmm. The other thing, too, is it's relatively shallow, which is quite important. It's within 300 meters. So very exciting start. Again, you know, having done that deal with Denison, starting the drill program, being fully funded for upcoming drill programs as well is an important part. And I think that's helped kind of lift Sky Harbor out of that, nano cap or micro cap mm-hmm. territory to continue to grow the company.
There was a lot of, especially over the last few years, as Fission and NextGen kind of took off, there were a lot of Me Too plays in the Athabasca, a lot of even questions about the bigger guys as to how you're actually going to get at the ore, even if you discover it. There's frozen lakes to deal with or unfrozen lakes to give you the time of year. How easy is it going to be to get to production on your particular property if in fact you get there?
It's a great question. One of the things that's kind of come to light for us drilling at Mourne, you know, as I mentioned earlier, shallow mineralization. It's not under a lake. It's on land. One of the techniques that could potentially be used, it's actually a new technology being developed by Denison and Areva, called SABR, surface access borehole resource extraction, basically drilling a borehole down, jet boring high-grade uranium at the unconformity or in the sandstone, and then basically pumping that high-grade slurry up to surface. Obviously much lower costs associated with that. Given that it's shallow, it could potentially work. We're also potentially looking at an open pit scenario, depending on additional mineralization that could be discovered at the project. But we're kind of right at that cusp right now of if you are looking at a mining scenario, whether it be underground or open pit. You know, these are all questions, though, that are questions you know, we'd like to answer, but it's going to require more exploration. I want to highlight the fact that, you know, really our proposition for the shareholder, the investor, is that discovery potential and unlocking value through the drilling, right? You know, we will answer these questions with continued exploration and work and reports at the project. But, you know, it is important to keep in mind, you know, we still are relatively small cap. It is exploration. We're out there, much like NextGen, much like Fission, Alpha, Hathor, these other recent discoveries in the Athabasca Basin. Mm-hmm. We're at the early stages of that, right? We're looking to go out there. We know there's high-grade mineralization at Moore, at the Maverick Zone, but there's still a lot of upside there, and we'd like to go in there over the coming years, drill it, and prove that upside. And the big part, the big thing to note here is that we know the underlying geology is there for a much larger potential deposit. We're seeing all the right rocks. We're hitting high grade mineralization, mm-hmm. as I mentioned. So there is the potential there for a much larger system. One of the key things at this project was that the initial discovery at Maverick was made in the early 2000s. Well, at that time, exploration was different in the basin. One of the big things was they really weren't looking as much in the basement rock. You look at NextGen, you look at Fission, you look at the Griffin deposit at Wheeler's project, which is only 15 kilometers away from Moore. You know, these are basement-hosted high-grade deposits. Well, there hasn't been a whole lot of drill testing into the basement rock at Moore, at the Maverick Zone, or at other regional targets at the Moore project. So there's a lot of upside potential in the basement rock, as well as at the unconformity and in the sandstone, where most of that high-grade uranium mineralization is hosted at the known Maverick Zone. So, you know, it's exciting to know that we've gone back in. We've done a full reinterpretation of all the previous drilling. We've taken a good long hard look at the geochemistry and indicator minerals and elements in the drill core. That actually led us to this new high-grade discovery we made at the project about 100 meters away from the main Maverick high-grade lens. That was that 9% over a meter and a half. It was contained within just over 4 meters, of 4.5% U308. Well, this was in an area that hadn't been drilled before. There were two fences on either side. Mm-hmm. And we went back and we looked at the geochem at those two fences of holes that were drilled over 10 years ago. And geologically, it was quite interesting. We were seeing all the right geochemical indicators. We had anomalous uranium mineralization in those historical drill holes, so why not drill a couple holes in between? And that's what we did, and we hit some high-grade mineralization. So even within that kilometer and a half that's been systematically drilled, we're still finding new high-grade lenses. So it's exciting to see what we could find in those other 2.5 kilometers, but also at depth in the basement rock. So that's just the main Maverick Zone. There's also another 6 or 7 conductive corridors, much like we see at the 4-kilometer-long Maverick Zone, regional targets that really have yet to be properly tested, systematically drilled. Those are other areas that we can look to work on as well.
So if I think back a year ago, a year and a half ago, you know, there were a lot of companies bouncing around the Athabasca. Fission was getting some great results, and a lot of companies were coming in behind that and staking around that. But being the typical Canadian resources scene, there are a lot of Me Too guys. There are a lot of guys up there that would never ruin a good story by actually sticking a drill in it. And the fact that your first move is, hey, we've got some over here, we've got some over here, let's stick a drill in the middle and see if they connect, is I think what's largely separated you guys from that pack of also-rans. It's the thing that's moved you into serious thinker territory.
Yeah, you know, look, the drill rig's the truth machine, as we all know, and you know, I like the way you put it there. That's very true. We believe in our projects, right? We had a very specific set of criteria when we were looking to acquire these projects. You know, we just didn't want to buy something for the sake of buying something. We really do feel that, you know, our really kind of our MO is, you know, if we're going to build up a company in a difficult market, make sure that these projects work in a difficult uranium market, right? If they work in a difficult uranium market, they're surely going to work in a good uranium market. So, you know, if you can, right now, as I say, pluck the low-lying fruit. There's a lot of low-lying fruit out there given how depressed the uranium market is, but you can make it work. If you can make it work in a difficult market, that's very good news in a good market. And we do believe that the projects that we have, in particular at Moore, there is that potential to make this project work in a difficult market. I also want to note, you know, getting back to some of the recent success stories, NextGen Fission in particular, you know, you look at Denison at the Griffin deposit, you know, that's a big part of the Wheeler project as a whole, and what they're looking to do, they're develop a mine. You know, that Griffin, newly discovered Griffin deposit is an important part of that. You know, these are basement hosted. There's been new techniques used in the field, some new technologies and innovations used to make these discoveries. And even in a depressed uranium market as we've been in, mm-hmm. they've been able to generate significant returns for investors. Look at NextGen going from a $40 or $50 million market cap just a few years ago, eclipsing a $1 billion market cap while the price of the commodity has basically been chopped in half. So mm-hmm. what that shows you is there is still the potential there for significant returns upon a notable high-grade, world-class discovery, and that's what you have at NextGen, that's what you have at Fission, and it's paid off. Now, if we get into a situation where we actually start seeing the uranium price move in the right direction, I believe we're gonna see that in the next few years. And unlike a lot of other commodities, uranium, I believe, has a long way to move. If you look at the underlying fundamentals, if you look at the supply side in particular, no mines are making money right now. $20 spot price, there's not one mine in the world that's break even. And if you look at the price needed to incentivize new production to come online, new mines to be built, a lot of analysts are forecasting $55 to $65 uranium, basically triple where it is today. So it's not just that we believe uranium is going to start moving up, we believe it has a long way to move up, and that's important.
So that leads me to a question. If the spot price is so low that no one's actually making money selling it, why is anybody selling it? Is it just a case of just like losing as little money as you can for as long as you can? Or, I mean, it would make more sense to me for people to start saying, you know what, we're just going to stockpile it for a while.
Yeah, so great question. The simple answer to that is that most uranium companies, Cameco, Areva, any large producer is still selling a good quantity of their production into these long-term contracts. These contracts are still priced at $50, $60 a pound. However, this is where it gets interesting. 80% of those contracts expire in the next 6 years. So they have to go back, they'll have to renegotiate with the utilities companies and the fuel buyers. Now, it's not just about, and this is important to note, the fuel buyers, the nuclear utilities, you can't just buy yellow cake and put it into a reactor. There's a whole fuel fabrication process, and that can take upwards of 2 years. Mm-hmm. So if a contract that is supplying a nuclear reactor with uranium is set to expire in the next, call it 2 years, they're going to have to be talking and negotiating terms on a new contract now, because they need the fuel fabricated, and that can take a little while. So mm-hmm. we do know that a lot of these contracts, the vast majority of them, expire in the next 5 to 6 years. We know that they're going to have to be renegotiated. We've had a lot of secondary supply that's hit the market. So that's been the reason the spot price has pulled back as much as it has. Mm-hmm. But that only lasts for so long. And this is what we see time and time out in previous cycles. We saw this in the early 2000s before the price of uranium jumped up from $20 a pound to over $130 a pound. A big part of that move was this new contracting cycle, meaning pre-existing contracts expiring mm-hmm. and then new contracts, the fuel buyers coming back and entering into new contracts. We have, to answer your question and give some more light on the supply side, we have started to see supply go offline. We've seen companies, Cameco, for example, the largest publicly traded uranium company, has shut down their U.S. operations. They shut down Rabbit Lake. We've seen over 15% of primary mine supply cut back over the last 18 months as a result of low prices. Mm-hmm. A very important point when we talk about the supply side, Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan is the world's largest producer of uranium. They produce about 40% of the primary mine supply globally. They are basically like the Saudi Arabia, if you will, of uranium. And Kazakhstan just in January announced a 10% production cut. And talking a little bit about what we're seeing in the market here with the shares of these uranium companies, as well as the spot price, that announcement triggered a big run up in both the stocks and the spot price. Mm-hmm. We saw many companies, as you probably recall, double or triple in a very short period of time on just that 10% production cut, which really did kind of come out of nowhere. There's speculation that they were going to cut because the price is too low. But that just shows you Kazakhstan's the lowest cost producing region in the world. When the lowest cost producing region in the world is forced to announce and cut back 10%, they've actually cut back a little bit more as per the last quarter. That's just showing you the kind of dire situation that's out there. Kazakhstan's also moving towards more, let's call it a Western style of operating, whereby instead of selling a lot of their material on the spot market, a lot of their production on the spot market, they do sell relative to other large producers a large quantity of their production on the spot market, which hurts spot price. They want to have what's called inventory management. They'll set up a Swiss sub and they can time the sales of their production better. That way they're not selling into a weak or illiquid spot market. That's another very important point that a lot of people are not talking about. Underfeeding has been a big source of secondary supply, and I won't get into the details of that, but basically you can think of it as there being excess capacity at the enrichers, and more material gets sold back into the spot market. Japan, we know that's been one of the biggest sources of secondary supply, but the Japanese are restarting their reactors. We saw the two Takahama reactors come back online. So as they start turning these reactors back on, as they have just started doing, not only are they going to need the uranium, they're clearly not going to be selling it into the spot market, which will be positive. Mm-hmm. And last, the Department of Energy, and just a few months ago, they finally announced that they'd be selling less uranium back into the spot market. So we're starting to see, we are starting to see the market respond on the supply side to these low prices. And I think you'll see more of that because we still are trading at $20 a pound. That's near all-time lows in inflation-adjusted terms. Mm-hmm. You simply cannot produce the stuff economically at $20, even $25 a pound. The average global cost of production is above $40 a pound. So that gives you an idea. Even the current mines out there, once these contracts start rolling off, you're very likely to see additional supply cuts if we do not see the price increase.
Can utilities exist on spot sales, or are those long-term contracts just too important to lock down supply?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at historically the volumes traded on the spot versus the contract market, the spot market historically is only maybe 15 to at most 20% on an annual basis.
Okay.
Now, the last few years, it's been a bit more because there's been a weak market. But in normal years and in normal markets, you typically see kind of 15 to 20% of the volume on the spot market. The rest is all long-term contract market. So utilities, if you were to see utilities step into the spot market in a meaningful way, the spot price is going to gap up pretty quickly.
Right. So in terms of the demand for uranium, I mean, obviously we're seeing a lot of reactors being built in China. There's a bunch in the U.S. that are starting to make, like, they're coming together. Environmentally, traditionally, people have looked at nuclear energy as being the evilest of energy. But, you know, tsunamis aside, it's a pretty clean way to go compared to some of the alternatives.
Yeah, and, you know, I always kind of get a kick out of that. You know, it's ironic to me that, you know, it is viewed that way. I do understand, you know, there's this angle that the media, especially in the Western world, takes on nuclear. There's a good documentary actually CNN did called Pandora's Promise. I recommend any viewer to go and watch that to, you know, get a better kind of rounded picture of the nuclear space. The reality of it is nuclear is still the only baseload 24/7 source of electricity that's CO2 free. It's that simple. Renewables, I'm a big believer in renewables, but they're not baseload power yet. And if you look at the global picture, let's look outside of, you know, our North American or Western European bubble for a second. Air quality is a big problem in a lot of developing countries. In particular, if you look at China, you get these orange alerts. You can Google it or YouTube it. You know, check out, you know, smog rolling into Beijing, a 20-minute time lapse of a beautiful sunny day turning into what appears to be a very foggy day, and actually it's just pollution. So, you know, this is a serious problem in many countries around the world. That's just on the air pollution side. Now, renewables will be a big part of that solution, but so will nuclear, right? It's important to think of nuclear as a part of the energy mix, right? You know, it's not necessarily the be-all and end-all, but nor are renewables, right? It's important to have a diversified energy mix. Nuclear is baseload power. It's 24/7. You don't need the wind blowing. You don't need the sun shining. And if it's done right, it's very safe. It employs a lot of people. It's a big boost to the economy. It's efficient. And you're not relying, as you are with fossil fuels, on other jurisdictions. If you look at what France did, for example, when they built out their nuclear facilities and power plants in the 80s and 90s, after the supply oil supply crisis in the 70s, they realized that they couldn't be at the mercy of the oil market, right? Economically, it was a bit of a disaster. Japan, similar kind of thing. So they built up a reactor base, and that's allowed them to, in France's case, produce some of the cheapest electricity of any country in Europe. They have some of the lowest carbon emissions per capita of any country in Europe. And so it's an important, and they're 78% nuclear, right? So it's important to look at both sides of this, right? It gets a bad rap in the Western media, but the reality of it is in other parts of the world, like China, where you have 1.5 billion people, India, over 1 billion people, parts of Africa, it's going to be an important part of electrifying these parts of the world. We know this much for sure. The standard of living is directly correlated to the amount of electricity that the average individual has access to, right? When you look at the wealthiest nations in the world, well, you have cheap electricity, and you have electricity. There's lots of parts of the world that don't still. So, you know, on looking at it kind of from a more diverse criteria set, nuclear is going to play an important part in the energy mix going forward. And that will be the case in these developing countries, whether you're looking at it from air quality, air pollution standpoint, just, you know, the generation of electricity, getting it, that electricity into the grid. Nuclear is here to stay. And, you know, on that note, there are some new advanced nuclear technologies being developed, some well-known investors, including Bill Gates, Peter Thiel, that are putting lots of money into this, modular reactors, molten salt reactors, with lots of new technologies being developed to make it even safer, even more economic, and more efficient. And so I think that, you know, maybe 10, 15 years down the road, you know, this industry is going to look different. But at the end of the day, the only self-fissile naturally occurring element out there is uranium. We happen to have a thorium deposit on one of our projects tied in with a uranium deposit we have at Falcon Point. And thorium's been getting a lot of positive media attention, and we're believers in it, but it's going to take time to develop and commercialize thorium reactors. The reality of thorium too is that to actually get the reaction started, you need to have uranium. You need to have a critical mass of uranium to start the fission reaction. So uranium and uranium-fueled reactors, I believe, are here to stay, certainly in the next 20 or 30 years. As you talked about the buildup of nuclear reactors, there's 59 reactors under construction right now. A third of those are in China. That's a significant amount of new capacity coming online. A lot of people don't know this. More nuclear electricity came on the grid last year than any year in the last 40 years, right? So we are seeing new nuclear reactors being built. They're Gen 3 reactors or new reactors. They consume a lot more uranium and produce a lot more electricity. They're safer. They employ a lot of people. You know, that's a big thing when we talk about jobs in certain countries. You know, this is a big industry, and it employs a lot of people. It's good for the economy because it employs people, and it also generates a lot of clean, cheap electricity.
So we've got a few questions here from our chatters. There's actually quite a few. Any guess when the spot price will start to recover is the first?
I believe it'll be in the next 12 months. You know, if we look at the price action on the spot market over the last, call it 24 months, we've seen a pretty precipitous decline. We saw, though, how responsive the spot market was earlier this year to a supply cut from Kazakhstan. So that's important because that's showing, and the equities obviously as well, that's showing you that the market is ready for good news to take hold. What we've seen recently with the price pulling back is really just one seller, Tochu, and you know, maybe who knows what's going on with them in the market there. But it's important to note it's relatively light volumes, right? Time of year, there's some seasonality there. Right. It's relatively light volume. So, you know, we are seeing volatility. You do see volatility at tops and bottoms of markets. I do believe we're at the bottom, and you know, volatility will stay in it until I think the big you know, the spot market's one thing, that I think the big source of real fundamental price movement will come when we see the utilities companies, the nuclear fuel buyers, coming back into the market. Now, we know when these contracts are expiring, and we know that it's sooner rather than later. So from that point of view, and we saw the impact it can potentially have on the market, where, you know, from the years 2004 to 2007, there was a significant increase in the price, both the spot price and the contract price. And a lot of that was driven by this new contracting cycle.
And those new reactors, as they get closer to coming online, they're going to be needing their own long-term contracts kicked into gear. So the growth pattern looks pretty solid over the next, say, 3 to 5. And if your operation is moving forward at the speed that it has been, I'm guessing that 3 to 5 years would be where you'd be looking at as being a rational time when you could move to production if all goes well.
Yeah, and that's a good point. I you know, that's actually a great point to highlight, right? You know, the last thing I'd want to be doing at $20 uranium right now, to be honest, is producing uranium, right? I mean, producing it at, you know, even at the lowest cost producing mine, break even at $22 uranium, you're losing money, right? So good situation to be in, or a much better situation to be in, is on the exploration or development side, where you're looking to advance projects towards production. But ideally, what you have is the project producing when the prices have recovered. You are making money. It's economic. And I just want to kind of note one other thing with Sky Harbor. We talked a lot about our flagship, more the discovery potential, looking to go out there and continue to add pounds and prove up additional high-grade mineralized zones at that project. That's the main catalyst for the company. We're fully funded for two programs coming up. But we do have a secondary strategy. And further to to that question, you know, working towards developing and production at these projects, we actually do employ the prospect generator model as an exploration company, and we look to do that with our other projects. We have four other projects, big property package scattered throughout the basin. We want to bring in strategic partner companies to fund the exploration, so we don't have to keep raising money and diluting. They come in, they fund the work, they pay us in cash and stock as well, so we do get a bit of cash flow coming in on an annual basis. as they earn into the project, and we get to team up with real strong geological teams. A perfect example of us executing on this business model or secondary strategy is a deal we just consummated a few months ago with Areva. Areva is an industry leader out of France. A lot of people probably familiar with Areva. They've optioned in or are optioning into one of our projects, our Preston project over by Fission NextGen. It's an $8 million deal, $7.3 million in exploration over 6 years, and $700,000 in cash. They'll be funding the exploration. They'll be carrying out the work, advancing the project. We retain a minority interest. We have a strategic partner in Areva. We also did consummate another deal after that with a company called Azincourt, again, earning in 70% on our project. This is the East Preston for $3.5 million in work and cash, as well as some shares on top of that. So it's important to note that, you know, it's not just all about the drill bit. We do have additional programs being carried out and funded by strategic partners that are coming in on some of the secondary projects.
The prospect generator model gets not a lot of love on the markets traditionally, here and there, but most people don't see the value in the scout team that you might see in professional sports. Do you think that that's going to change over time? You certainly got like the high level partners in Areva and Denison. You couldn't really ask for any bigger fish to be floating along underneath. You know, do you think that you're genuinely a prospect generator, or are you more likely to become a mini major at some point?
Yeah, no. You know, first and foremost, we're a discovery company, right? We're exploration, discovery driven. Our MOR project is the main project that's going to provide the main source of news, the main catalyst for the company and driver for the company. But, you know, I've seen this, I think, as have you and your subscribers and viewers, that a lot of companies over time build a good portfolio of projects. We spent 4 years doing this. Mm-hmm. We've been very patient, but we've also been very opportunistic with our acquisitions. It's my opinion that it's a shame to let these assets sit there and collect dust, right? So that's why I say, as a secondary strategy behind the discovery potential and unlocking value through the drill bit at MOR, we employ the prospect generator model on our secondary projects and
the
four projects that we have. You know, to answer your question, you know, do I see this? Because you're right, there are a lot of companies that are just prospect generators, and they don't get a lot of love in the market. And hence the reason we're going 100% focused in drilling at our MOR project, because, you know, we do feel we have a lot of value to be unlocked there through our own drilling. But, you know, I do see, as, you know, you hear experts in our industry talk about this all the time, the prospect generator model does get love when new discoveries and these projects really turn out and work out for these companies, right? When you have new discoveries made, and even though you don't have a majority interest or a full interest on the project, you still retain a minority interest. You still get the benefit and see value creation from the discovery that was made by the partner company working in on the project. So to answer your question, yes, you know, I do think there is some, you know, the market discounts the prospect generator model in the short term, but over the long run, as more and more companies and projects are advanced through the prospect generator model without as much equity dilution for the main company, it does see significant returns in the market, but it just is a more of a longer term approach.
It's almost like paying a dividend. People kind of scratch their head and say, "What's that? I don't remember anyone doing that in the last couple of years."
Exactly. Absolutely.
Yeah, you're obviously a young guy. You know, the resources market traditionally has been an older man's game. The younger executives don't necessarily or haven't necessarily got the easy path to financiers and the trust in the market. If I look at someone like Steve DeJong at Integra Gold and yourself at Sky Harbor, it strikes me that over the last year or so, the rules seem to be changing. The younger guys seem to be looking to build a reputation rather than just build a market cap, and they're getting a lot more trust than they have previously. Is that your experience?
I think that's a part of it. You know, Steve DeJong and I were on a panel, the Young Leaders panel at the conference, and, you know, we got asked this very question. You know, I do think there is a transition happening right now, a changing of the guards, if you will. Our industry, in the mining industry, as you're well aware, seems to lag other industries when it comes to technological and innovation. I think there's a place right now for, maybe the younger, more technologically savvy entrepreneurs and company builders to come in and take the reins. And, I would highlight on that note, I am a young guy. I bring passion and energy day in, day out. I love what I do. I love building a company. You're right. My main goal and really only goal here is to build a great company, create as much shareholder value as I can. Ultimately, I'd love to sell the company to be acquired by a larger company, much like Steve's done. But that is really the end goal here at Sky Harbor. But I'm not just the only one working at Sky Harbor, and as we talk about what what really makes these companies successful, what are common denominators, one of the biggest factors is the people, the management, the technical team, and also the shareholder base, right? Who are some 50 shareholders? I started running the company and basically founded it 4 years ago with an idea and a vision. We put together, I think, one of the best teams out there with focused expertise in the Athabasca Basin, exploration expertise, right? You want to have a team that knows how to go out and execute on the business plan, on the model, and ours is going out and finding high-grade uranium in the Athabasca Basin. My head geologist, who I teamed up with right away, Rick Dismersky, he's a veteran. He's a 40-year veteran in this industry. He spent many years at Cameco. He was a senior geologist there, exploration manager for many years. He left and he built his own company called JNR. And I talked a little bit about that and the history there at the flagship we now have more, which was in JNR back in the mid-2000s. To give you an idea, when Rick was running JNR in 2006, 2007, the company was trading at over a $350 million market cap. The two main projects in that company, Moore Lake, our flagship now, and Falcon Point, which we also have. But we also have three other projects, Creston, Murchison, and Man Lake. Creston, the one we just announced an option deal with Areva on. So that just shows you.
So you're less than 10% of his market cap.
Yeah, that's exactly. That just shows you the cyclicality of the industry. But you know what? That creates opportunity. So yeah. Rick is credited, him and his team, Dave Billiard, Christine McKechnie, they found a lot of uranium in their day. And actually, his nickname is Radioactive Rick. So, Rick has been a huge part of our team. He's a cornerstone part of the team. He's a large shareholder. He's our head geologist, and he's the one really calling the shots in the field because he knows what he's doing out there. Dave Cates, as I mentioned, the president and CEO of Denison Mines, really built a great working relationship with him and his team. And as I said earlier, they're our largest strategic shareholder. Jim Pettit, who I've worked with for a number of years, he's my chairman. Bayfield Ventures, I worked with him at Bayfield Ventures, a gold company, which we built and sold to New Gold. And then last but not least, Paul Matysik, well-known company builder in our space.
We know Matysik.
Sold four companies in the last 12 years, the biggest one being Energy Metals, uranium company he took from a $10 million valuation in 2004. He sold it to Uranium One for $1.8 billion in 2007. So, we have done one of the main things that we've tried to focus on is building a team that one knows how to go out there and execute on the business plan, on the model, but also it brings a good mix of youth, energy, passion, as well as many, many years of experience and focused expertise, specifically in the Athabasca Basin.
So if we look at your share chart, your price chart over the last year, there's been some ups, there's been some downs, but definitely the trend line in a down uranium market, in a filthy uranium market, let's be honest, has been upwards for you. You obviously still see there to be a lot of value to be had. But it's clearly your company value has gone against the grain of the general market. Do you see other companies doing the same thing, or because I don't see a lot of them?
There's a few. I think I'll start by just saying you really need to kind of take a step back and look at the whole uranium space, right? Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of companies left, quite frankly. It's not just the small cap junior exploration companies, but, you know, there's been producers that have struggled. Look at Paladin. The mid-tiers and developers as well, we've seen a significant correction. There's just not a lot of these companies left. On that note, a little bit of money coming back into the sector is going to have a significant impact. We've also seen over the last 4 or 5 years, a lot of capital leave the sector, hence the valuations you're seeing. Specifically for Sky Harbor, it's getting back to the first question you asked, and what's really changed with the company in the last year. A lot has, right? And we've done some significant deals. We've had some initial drilling success at our flagship. We're bringing in strategic partner companies to advance secondary projects. The news flow has been good. We have a lot more news coming out. I think that's the key thing here, is that we're in the summer doldrums. Clearly, we've seen the broader market, resource market, correct. But the company's, in my opinion, the strongest position it's been in. We just raised $2.7 million, most of that at 60 cents a premium, no warrant, mostly institutional. Investors coming in on that round. We're fully funded with just over $3.7 million for the next 18 months. Multiple drill programs coming up at more, but we now have our partner companies, Areva, Azincourt, coming in and starting their exploration programs at Creston. So lots of news flow. Getting back to kind of the broader picture, the bigger picture with uranium, look, as an investor in this space, it excites me to know that we haven't seen that big run up yet, right? Mm-hmm. This is early stages of a recovery, and arguably one of the biggest catalysts for share price appreciation, the underlying commodity, we have yet to really see that happen, right? So that's exciting, knowing that you can take a position in a company that's leveraged to that commodity price, and when it starts to move, and there's not many other companies out there doing it, it's going to be exciting.
I think it's exciting right now. I think looking at your chart there, it looks like the beginnings of another swing up. If the cycles of the last year are anything to go by, congratulations on building what you built. It's been a nice journey for you, and I know that the growing level of respect out there for your company in a sector that doesn't always get a lot of respect is indicative of your team doing something very right.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. And, we're really just getting started. We got a lot of work ahead of us, but I think we have a good base right now. We're looking to continue building on that. As I mentioned earlier, we have a lot of news flow coming out, a lot to prove up on the projects. We are looking to also bring in additional partners at some of the other secondary projects we have. So a lot to look forward to, not just with the company and company specific news, but also with the commodity as well. I really do believe, this is one of the best contrarian and deep value opportunities out there that we've seen in a very long time. The $1 million question always is when, it's real tough to pick tops and bottoms. The trick is smelling out good value opportunities. And I think looking at almost any uranium company right now, that's the case. I do think we're going to see significant price movement over the coming years with the underlying commodity.
We've got one last question here from the chat. Is what is the CEO's thoughts on thorium?
On thorium?
Yeah.
Is it? Yeah. I talked a little bit about it earlier. There's, it's getting more and more attention in the mainstream media. And there was a good TED talk on it. We're one of the few companies that has an NI 43-101 thorium deposit in North America. We have an advisor who is a thorium expert. I like thorium, needless to say, a bit of a biased opinion, given that we do have a thorium component to Sky Harbor. I would say it's probably a few years out, though, realistically, before it's commercialized. Really, most of the R&D for thorium is being carried out in developing countries. Unfortunately, not a lot of R&D dollars have been put into it in North America or Western Europe, because billions and billions of dollars have been sunk into the new uranium fueled nuclear industry. Mm-hmm. We have these big reactors that are operating now that need uranium. So there really hasn't been the impetus to develop thorium reactors in the Western world. But I do see it as potentially down the road. It's not necessarily a substitute. You can't just simply put thorium into uranium-fueled nuclear reactor. You need to see a new fleet of thorium reactors come online. But, you know, if we're looking 5 to 10 years out, uranium is that's it for the nuclear industry, in my opinion.
It's going to be interesting watching. We're going to let you go. You've given us a good hour of your time. I appreciate it. I know you've got a busy day. Just on the edge, how was the convention for you on Monday?
It was great. It was busy. And usually this time of year, that's tricky. Yeah. We also have some of the nicest weather we've had here in Vancouver in a long time. I spend a lot of time on the road, but it was the few sunny days that I've seen being back here. It was great. I think they did a good job with the speakers, with the companies that were there, quality. It was in... It wasn't too diluted. I mean, the problem with some of these conferences is, there's PDAC bigger conferences is you're one of hundreds of companies there, right? And that's tough, not just for the company, but for the investor, right?
Yeah.
Or people walking around, it's tough to kind of walk away with, knowing the story of 200 companies and being able to pick from that. So it's good. It was nice and intimate and gave everyone the opportunity to chat and that's what I think conferences should be like.
Well, it led us to talking to you, so that's a win in itself. Thanks, man. I appreciate your time, and let's touch base again sometime in the future when you got some news piling up.
Perfect. That'll be very soon, so thank you very much.
All right, man. That was Jordan Trimble on the phone from just down the street. Good questions, you guys. I appreciate that. We sometimes, when you get into an industry where guys have been beaten up, it's hard to get things out of them. They tend to sort of talk in circles. But Jordan Trimble is somebody who you wind him up, you point him in the right direction, and he will talk to you about uranium for a long time. So that's good. It's an interesting field. If you look at the numbers, the new uranium exploration around the world, the Athabasca Basin has like 8 times more exploration going on than anywhere else, any other country. So if uranium does go up, it's going to be a good deal for Canada. Hookley is saying, would love to hear Kudiguru's opinion on Anfield Resources, another uranium company that seems to be fairly solid. Fairly new to the game, so I'm not sure I would love your opinion. You know what, Hookley? I haven't looked at Anfield for a while. I'd say about 6 months ago, I was chatting to them, but I really haven't kept up with their news. But I will put it on my list of things to look at. The price chart looks very much like most uranium companies over the last 6 months, where you had the big jam up in December, January, and sort of a trail off. To now, really anything that you get into uranium wise, the price is going to be largely anchored to the market itself. There's no one really sort of sticking their head out and suddenly signing contracts or throwing new tech down, or everyone who's got a chance at uranium right now is priced by the market, and the market is a little oversaturated on the spot side. So as Jordan said, as we go a couple of years down the line, those long-term contracts are going to need to be renegotiated. And as long as nobody goes in there and hangs himself by doing silly deals, uranium should be on the ascendancy in the next year or two. Segment idea, says Braden, I'll hang up and listen. All research requests from listeners. Yeah, that's not a bad idea. I've tried to throw Galen the task of researching companies that we've been asked about that haven't been in the frame for us, but he hasn't really got to it yet. But I think that doing a show now and then where we ask you guys for every ticker that you have a notion for and going and doing a dig, is it makes a lot of sense. In fact, Braden, that could be your next article if you're volunteering. Ookley, thanks for joining. We haven't seen you around here before, I don't think, but feel free to favor the channel so that you get your notifications when we do a show.
You've been listening to Equity Gurus, A Closer Look. See you next time.
Thanks for listening. For disclosure statements and more info, please visit www.equity.guru.